inscriptions on the Temple of Delphi. Each of the students of the Keeper of Knowledge had their own story, their own path that led them to him. Each of them had experienced powerful emotions at some point in their lives, emotions that had changed their previous limited view of the world and inspired them to seek the truth. For some, it was the joy of the most beautiful things in the material world, happy love, world travels, or even a career that turned out to be a calling. For others, it was a tragedy.
Such is fate.
All disciples of the Keeper of Knowledge had heard this phrase, and it raised questions for each of them that neither science nor religion could explain. Love, happiness, and hope became understandable once they were truly felt. But fate did not take a form that was easily comprehensible. What defined a person's life was entirely inaccessible to their understanding. The students felt excitement and even some embarrassment at the fact that the sage was revealing to them the greatest mysteries of the world. What role did fate play in a person's life? Could it be compared to a vast web where each life was marked by a thread and was only a part of something greater? Or was fate a servant of the soul, meant to lead it to God through the experiences lived?
"We will understand nothing in this world until we know ourselves,"
said one of the students as they all settled in the hall.
"In that case, the mystery of our fate lies within us,"
another student replied, turning her gaze to the stage, waiting for the sage. Once the students calmed their minds and prepared for the conversation, the Keeper of Knowledge appeared in the hall. He warmly smiled at his students and took the stage.
"In the city of Delphi, several centuries before our era, a temple was erected to the god Apollo, which for centuries was the center of cultural life in ancient Greece."
The sage began his narrative.
"In this temple lived the Pythias, who possessed the gift of foresight and, at the request of people, predicted their future. However, they always did so metaphorically, so that each person understood it in their own way."
The Keeper of Knowledge had a way of storytelling that painted vivid images in the minds of his students, like picturesque paintings, and his narrative guided their thoughts in the right direction. Many present here were familiar with Greek culture and had already pictured the temple surrounded by columns and priests in chitons. Others imagined something more familiar to their own eyes, but no less close to the truth as conveyed by the teacher.
"The Pythias knew that life is the school of God, and a person's knowledge of their future deprives it of meaning. If a person is content with their fate, they will simply follow the plan prepared for them, without thinking about it."
The sage continued to explain.
"But for most people, which is more common, knowing their fate for years ahead, they won't be able to accept it."
A blue-eyed girl with chestnut hair raised her hand, and when the teacher nodded to her, she asked a question.
"So, does attempting to change our fate bring only harm? Why then did the Pythias tell people anything at all? Just to reassure them, like a child with a toy?"
"In part, that is correct, Jana,"
the teacher replied with a smile.
"Indeed, people are comforted by knowledge, even though most often it's just an illusion of knowledge. Nevertheless, a prophecy told in the form of a riddle can be beneficial for a person. It can make them reflect on their actions and help them avoid misfortunes sent for their learning. This way, a person can become wiser, avoiding suffering that could have been avoided. But sadly, this doesn't always happen. As I mentioned before, often a person cannot accept their fate. Think, Jana, how would you feel about your life if you knew it all in advance? Let's say you're 15, and you found out everything about your future up to today."
"I wouldn't be able to accept it,"
the girl shook her head.
"In my youth, I denied many things, including any belief. It was easier for me to think that there was no God, that nothing beyond the reach of our intellect existed. I believed that only material things were real. And if I had known that I would eventually practice yoga, I would have thought I was just being foolish."
and then other lessons would be sent to you that would lead to much greater spiritual suffering than you have endured. That's why a person should not know their destiny exactly. Without the knowledge they gather on their life path, they won't understand what the future holds for them and may make mistakes they could have avoided,
replied the Keeper of Knowledge, sending an energy of support and unconditional acceptance.
The Pythias understood this, and to guide people on their life path, they inscribed 7 phrases on the gates of their temple. Each of them required interpretation, just like prophecies. Let's begin with the one that, at first glance, seems the most mysterious. The meaning of life lies in its completion. What do you think it means?
Probably it's about the experience we gain by the end of our lives,
suggested a slender young man with delicate facial features and attentive blue eyes.
And about whether we can accept God, absorb his lessons, how much we will develop, what wisdom we will gain. Otherwise, in the next life, everything will start over. And degrading by the end of life is also possible, then the soul will totally bounce back.
You're right, Eric.
The sage nodded to him.
Glory, power, wealth, family are not the goals of our life, as we will leave all of these behind after death. As Jesus said, gather treasures in heaven, where neither decay, nor rust, nor thieves can steal them. It is this that will be eternal. And these treasures are the state of our soul, how full it is of noble thoughts and emotions, how awakened our consciousness is, and how strong our connection with God is. Only our soul, along with the experience it has gathered, will accompany us in the next life. But how can we protect our soul? As you correctly noted, there's a risk of bouncing back. The Pythias knew this too, and the next inscription reads, in the crowd there is no good.
Saying this, the Keeper of Knowledge looked around at the gathered students, encouraging them to express their thoughts.
Teacher, may I share?
Raised his hand a strongly built young man with a mop of curly ash blonde hair. The sage immediately noticed his embarrassment and sent his student an energy of support and boundless love.
In my childhood, I often visited my grandfather in the village, and a shepherd lived next to my grandfather's house. One day, he didn't close the pen properly, and his flock of sheep got out at night. They wandered around for a long time, but it ended with them falling into a ravine, one after another. The sheep that were following could see what was happening to those ahead, but they still kept going.
The young man took a moment to catch his breath and continued.
When I saw what happened to those sheep, I burst into tears. My grandfather was very wise, and instead of scolding me, he told me to remember that blindly following someone is not right. He said that God had sent those sheep as a lesson for us. My grandfather was a deeply religious man, and in the village people considered him a fool because of it. But he also told me that if I learned this lesson, then those sheep didn't die in vain. And then he gave me a lamb as a gift so I wouldn't be sad. He said that if I raised it as a pet and didn't let it join the flock, it wouldn't do anything foolish. And that's what happened. The lamb grew up quite smart, roamed around with my grandfather's dog, and even understood commands. And in the village they continued to gossip about my grandfather, but his modest farm was always in good order, while most of his neighbors constantly had troubles.
About life in a crowd being nothing but trouble, the Pythias also knew. As the next phrase goes, most people are foolish.
The teacher continued.
Foolishness, whether in ancient Greece or today, is the same. Let's take, for example, the village where Matthew and his grandfather lived. It's not hard to imagine its life. Someone is drinking, someone is gossiping, and someone out of anger decides to set their neighbor's house on fire so that they too will suffer. The local community is like a boiling cauldron, not allowing others to escape. Everyone watches to make sure the other person suffers just like they do. So life in the crowd is always suffering, even if you don't do evil to anyone yourself.
Yes, that's how everyone lived in the village. Everyone who was part of the local community suffered. I was terrified to see people turning savage.
Nodded. the student, for whom such a personal revelation helped him finally overcome his old fear.
It seems that was a lesson for me as well.
The Keeper of Knowledge nodded to him.
Exactly. And you've learned the lesson well. You managed to see the influence of the crowd and moved away from it. Only a few, like Christ and Buddha, can teach goodness. But the desire to live like everyone else is a self-imposed sentence. As a person willingly submits to the mercy of the insane crowd, which not only destroys each other through wars and revolutions, but also executes great individuals. Christ was crucified precisely by the will of the crowd.
The students listened with reverence to the Keeper of Knowledge, holding their breath.
Now let's move on to the fourth inscription. Measure is more important than anything.
The sage continued.
Even the crowd knows about harmful habits and squandering, though they don't apply this knowledge for their own benefit. How many people, with a smirk, say that they still have 20 years left to pay off their mortgage when asked why they don't want to travel or find a hobby for their own development? Instead of the development, they have a debt pit, three jobs, and constant agony. The things they took loans for no longer bring them joy, and the mortgage department has become like a prison. But there's also a hidden enemy that's not easy to recognize. The lack of moderation in one's perception, like a glass that's half full for an optimist and half empty for a pessimist. Neither of them sees the situation as a whole. For example, someone took a loan, be it out of foolishness or need. Right now, they have a lot of money. That's what an optimist will think. But later they will have to repay it with interest. That's what the pessimist will focus on. The realist, on the other hand, will assess the situation as a whole and seek the most reasonable way out of it. But there are more complicated matters. Let's take charity, for example. Do you think there can be too much of it?
Teacher, I have a whole story.
Eric returned to the conversation.
I started my path to enlightenment with the help of the poor. Even in my childhood, my mother explained that beggars are deliberately sent to collect alms for the bandits, and sometimes even their own relatives, so we should only give them food and drink. But as I grew up, I realized that it's even more complicated, and that even organizations that start with the goal of helping the needy can end up misusing the money. Moreover, many of the poor decide that living off charity is easier and get upset when someone refuses to pay for their whims.
That's right. This is what happens when goodness is done to excess. It ceases to be good. We must maintain balance like on a pair of scales.
The Keeper of Knowledge replied.
On these scales are not good and evil, but our desires. Goodness is in equilibrium, in the golden middle, while evil resides in extremes.
Beloved teacher.
A petite hazel-eyed brunette joined the conversation.
The same is said in verses. Each planet has qualities, but as soon as any of them starts to prevail, it turns into a deficiency. But is it possible to do the opposite? Take a negative quality, like despotism, and by moderating it, make it positive? After all, strictness is attention and a sense of responsibility. It's because of them that parents don't allow their child to play near the road or go with strangers.
You understand everything correctly, Rosa.
The Keeper of Knowledge warmly smiled at his student.
Strictness helps love from going blind. A child can be spoiled or not adequately prepared for life due to excessive care. And strictness will not allow such a thing. But if strictness outweighs, parents may persecute the child. Here's another example. Idleness. A person is always cheerful and doesn't take anything seriously, living in the clouds. But moderate idleness is joy that brings relief. So everything should be in moderation. One quality should compensate for another. We develop lacking qualities and temper excessive ones, and then we balance them. All of this is done through spiritual practices, and by distancing ourselves from the insane crowd.
Teacher, I also have a story.
A curly-haired, red-haired man raised his hand.
My uncle, just like me now, once decided to embark on self-improvement. However, he did everything his way. At first, he bought a lot of books on philosophy and religion, read them all, and didn't like any of them. Then he started arguing with everyone, saying that everyone had tormented him. Eventually, he went to live in the forest. But I doubt that he achieved any enlightenment there.
If he didn't follow the great individuals, he could only arrive at madness instead of anything else. Without the aspiration upwards, following the path shown to us by the great ones, we remain part of the crowd.
The teacher shook his head.
What your uncle initially thought with his own mind was good and correct, but foolishly rejecting the wisdom of the great sages led him away from the right path. Physically, he left the crowd, but his mind remained there, and that's where the madness came from. But now, we've decided to leave the crowd and follow the great ones. How can we plan our steps towards perfection? The Pythias gave us a clue, and for this, the fifth inscription on the temple says, "Everything has its time." At first glance, it's a simple phrase that the crowd loves to use, instructing us on what to do. When to study, when to get married, when to have children. And everything comes untimely. Our profession turns out to be unnecessary. The marriage falls apart. The children grow up in poverty and repeat their parents' mistakes. In our society, it's common to marry early, no matter to whom, and to have children quickly, without considering the child's destiny. In the West, people are more sensible. They get married after 30, when they're already stable and ready, both morally and financially, to start a family. That's why they live wealthier lives. But can you really tie a person's maturity to their age? Many teenagers think more maturely than 40-year-olds.
At this point, the keeper of knowledge noticed the eager look in one of his students, Rosa. She wanted to share a story from her own life that she had remembered. And after receiving a nod from the teacher, she began.
It's so remarkable in my family. Everything worked out differently. Everyone did things untimely according to the crowd's standards. My parents got married when they were over 40. Almost all their friends had already divorced by then. But their life experiences formed similar worldviews and interests, so their marriage was successful. But even more interesting is my cousin. He's known his wife since childhood. Without any life experience, it turned out that he and she were on the same wavelength. It was almost like Romeo and Juliet, only with a happy ending. And my aunt went against the rules too, picking up a new profession when she was over 50. She became an artist. Now, the paintings she creates bring joy to the hearts of many people.
That's how real life looks, not languishing in the crowd.
The keeper of knowledge began sharing his wisdom again. When Rosa fell silent,
every life is unique. Destiny and the experiences of our past incarnations make it so. But who will guide us in this life? Who will show us when the right time for decisions and actions has come? This will be done by those who hide in the daylight in the mantle of sunlight, and whom we usually only see in the night sky. Planets and stars. There are aspects that need to be harmonized with. They will tell us what to do and when to do it. Celestial bodies will show us the right path.
But what should we do during an unfavorable aspect? We can't just lie down, as we might lose everything we've gained during a favorable aspect, and we might even bounce back.
Rosa asked a new question.
Perhaps we should tune in to God, and then the negative influence will disappear?
A negative aspect is not a bad influence. On the contrary, it's a time for self-improvement.
The sage corrected her.
During a good aspect, we take external actions, and they will be successful. But during a bad aspect, we should focus on the internal. challenges come with a negative aspect, and they are sent to us for self-work. During such times, we should reflect on what we are doing wrong, what harmful habits to overcome, and what to get rid of. Or perhaps you're facing the possibility of being fired during a bad aspect. But what kind of job is it? A hostile team, incompetent leadership, and unfair pay. Such a job only drags us down. Therefore, a bad aspect is a time for change and transformation, and we should turn it to our advantage.
Teacher, I feel hesitant to say this, but it has always seemed to me that the phrase, "everything has its time," implies something beyond our control. That both good and bad things come on their own. Doesn't this also happen?
The red-haired man asked, raising a new question.
That's only partially true, Artem. Only bad things happen to us on their own.
The keeper of knowledge replied.
People often say that a person found their love and changed. But that's not entirely accurate. A person who is degraded won't recognize love because they are already stupefied. But someone who starts to fight will see love as an opportunity for spiritual growth and will rise even higher. You see, the stages are crucial. Take a simple example. A person decides to bake a pie, but they don't know the process, so they do it randomly. They mix flour with jam, then add water, and it turns into a mess. But someone who knows the recipe will knead the dough correctly, prepare the filling, and bake it for the right amount of time to prevent it from burning. It's the same in life. Without timeliness, things can go wrong.
Teacher, how can we understand timing? Perhaps we should rely on intuition or the emotional center.
Jana asked again.
Exactly.
The sage nodded with a smile.
Timing relies on awareness. When you are aware, you understand when and what needs to be done. So we should always be attentive, like a cat lurking in a mouse's den. The cat is calm, yet ready to pounce as soon as the mouse appears. The cat remains calm and focused, not getting distracted or lying on its side, and its leap is an example of timeliness. That's how we should be, ready to jump at the right moment.
Beloved teacher, should we visualize the process of achievement in advance?
Eric asked.
Will it help us in the future, or will it confuse us? For example, when we're learning to bake a pie, we visualize what it will look like. Can this confuse us and distract our attention?
On the contrary, our imagination will help us. But we need to see not only the result, but also the process.
The keeper of knowledge began to explain.
We should visualize when to add what, how long to wait, and ensure that the process leads to the desired result. By closely monitoring the entire process, we will achieve the result we envisioned. Most people don't want to visualize the entire process in their minds, and that's another source of their failures.
At this point, the keeper of knowledge glanced at his audience, which had already absorbed the information presented, and was eagerly awaiting the discussion of the next inscription.
Well, the next inscription reads, "Trust only yourself." What are your thoughts on this?
Teacher, I've had some unfortunate life experiences. I've been deceived many times,
said a slim, hazel-eyed brunette, whose age was approaching 50 but hadn't diminished her charm in the slightest. The sage sensed that beneath her outward composure, the student concealed emotional pain, and thus, he sent her energy of support and boundless love. And then she continued,
"It happened that I once became a co-signer for a loan. My close friend, with whom I had been friends since school, asked me for this favor. The entire story with the loan, which I had to repay, became 100 times worse due to her betrayal. She told me it was time for me to feel like a failure, dredged up all childhood grievances, and even claimed that it was my fault her husband left her. This, despite the fact that her husband simply left to drink and found a new girlfriend somewhere in a bar. That's how my closest friend, once a sweet girl, gradually turned into a bitter woman who blamed everyone for her troubles.
No matter how close your friend is to you, you couldn't walk through life holding hands like you did in childhood. She took a different path at some point, and her soul was wounded.
The Keeper of Knowledge continued to explain.
That's precisely why we can't vouch for others. Everyone has their own life journey. Even if we start a journey with someone, our paths will still diverge. They may converge again, and many times they may run parallel. But they will never be identical. Often, even while walking alongside someone, you notice that you've both changed, but in different directions. That's how someone who loves you can turn into a scoundrel, ready to rob or even kill you. But such villains always wear a mask that hides their true essence.
Hearing this, most of the students lowered their eyes with sadness. Some sighed, and others shook their heads. Understanding their confusion, the sage once again sent his energy of unconditional love. A reminder that the world wasn't as lost as it often appeared.
Beloved teacher, after we discussed fate as the school of God and how people change, I've come to believe that we can't always rely on ourselves either.
Janna spoke, her gaze downcast.
All our thoughts are leading to the question of how to vouch for ourselves.
You've understood what was said perfectly.
The sage smiled at his student, who had once been a skeptic but had since traveled a long path of transformation.
The thing is, a person isn't whole. There's no single eye in them that both speak and acts. One eye might make a promise, but it's replaced by another eye that knows nothing of that promise. Our thoughts, born in the fog of the external world, deceive us. One eye might have a particular thought, while another eye has an opposing one. This is why, by believing every thought that arises in our heads, we decide to do one thing, but end up doing something entirely different. For a person's words and actions to be whole, they need to gather their true eye from 1,000 scattered pieces. And until that unity is achieved, there's nothing to say about vouching even for oneself.
Teacher, after such unification, will it be possible to discern whether there are others who are whole, or will we have to remain ignorant of another person's soul for our entire lives?
Artem asked a new question.
That's possible.
The sage nodded.
But before that, a person must accomplish the most crucial task, knowing oneself. This is precisely what the main 7th inscription on the Delphic Temple is about. All the previous 6 inscriptions are just hints leading up to it. A person has separated from the crowd, developed their attention, begun working on themselves, acquiring new knowledge, and only after all that are they ready to know themselves.
But how can we know ourselves, especially in such conditions where in society so many people are ready to drag us down?
Rosa asked.
And our other I might destroy us before we gather our true selves.
The sages of the past have already paved the way for us.
The Keeper of Knowledge replied.
Mindfulness includes being attentive to ourselves as well. We begin by observing our behavior in different situations, at home, at work, in social settings. Almost always, we behave differently and play various roles. By starting to observe our own mind, emotions, and body, we awaken our true self. This is our first step toward enlightenment, but it's significant because the true self is a fragment of God. Self-observation helps awaken the divine element within us, which then begins to transform our nature. Our thoughts and emotions become refined, our body becomes healthier, and our entire being undergoes a transformation. Following this, another mystery of our lives is revealed, that we don't remember ourselves, that we and everyone else are asleep. And to see everything as truly it is, we need to awaken. Persistent efforts in self-observation will help us cast off the thoughts and images that bewilder us, and then we will see the world as it truly is. At first, you may only see the bad things, but it will dissipate like the night at sunrise.
Beloved teacher, is it possible that our biobot could hinder us? Illness might strike us on the path to enlightenment.
Eric returned to the conversation.
I know that many great people had health problems, which they either overcame or made insignificant on their path. But what should we do when our biobot could betray us at any moment?
You've correctly noted that great individuals weren't halted by illnesses.
The sage replied with a smile.
That's because they understood how their biobot functions, what its functions are, and what they do. A human is a biobot. But when this biobot gains self-awareness, it ceases to be as dumb a machine as it once was. Knowledge provides the ability to control. Imagine a mechanism before us, initially incomprehensible, but once we study it, we can use it correctly. The same applies to our biobot. We purify ourselves from the influence of the crowd, train self-control and willpower, accumulate the necessary knowledge, and after that, we begin to take control of our own biobot.
Teacher, but we still remain dependent on our biobot, no matter how well we get to know it. Let's say we've fine-tuned all the functions of our biobot. It no longer blocks our self-awareness, who we are. But what should we do next?
Eric asked again.
After that, we attain freedom.
The teacher smiled, leading his students to the main knowledge of today's conversation.
The biobot is like a machine. The person sitting inside it is always limited. However, someone who knows how to control it can navigate through it, exploring the world around them. That's the maximum freedom in the material world. But once we have that, we become Atmans who can exit this machine. We step outside and can then observe our machine from the outside. Eventually, when this machine is no longer needed, we depart to God. That is the purpose of our earthly life.
Concluding his words, the Keeper of Knowledge sent an energy of support and boundless love to the gathered students. With their eyes closed, they imagined their souls finally attaining true knowledge, merging with God. The goal was still far off, but being in the teacher's aura provided them with a sense of peace and all-encompassing attention to the world. It felt as if the entire universe was spread before them, from flying comets to the rustling grass in the wind. Happiness and sorrow led to enlightenment, while attention kept them on the path. And in the minds of the students, there was a shared thought.
Right now, I'm here on Earth, but one day I will return to you, God.
To maintain this elevated state of being, the Keeper of Knowledge invited everyone to transition to a spiritual practice.
Do you want to know more? Watch the animated masterpiece that reveals the mysteries of humanity. Discover more sacred knowledge in books. You can meet the main characters of books at our seminars. Find your amulet of power. Participate in an individual ritual. Open free channel with daily spiritual practices for yourself. All these you will find on our website www.amazon1.org. Share this book and spread the great knowledge. Then people's lives will change for the better, and you will accumulate good karma and be able to help all your loved ones.